Ungainly compared to a wren, untuneful beside a nightingale, unkempt in the face of a peacock. The crow has a somewhat maligned image. But when was the last time you saw a crow close up? And when was the last time a crow looked right back at you? Have you ever wondered what goes on behind those dark, beady eyes? Well, it's a lot more than you might give crows credit for. In the second installment of our series, Exploring the Natural World Within Urban Environments, we delve into the realm of the crow. This is Living Planet. I'm Neil King, and this is DW's Tamsin Walker with her ode to the crow, or as she put it, a love song to the unsung.
I honestly can't recall a time when crows were not a part of my life, woven into my consciousness in the form of loyal sidekicks to literary witches, mystical figures in tales of animal wisdom, as ominous silhouettes perched on church spires, and through those awkward caws that drown out the dawn chorus to fill the skies with a particular brand of melancholy, they permanently nest in my mind's eye. And now, they're playing walnut football on my roof. And not for the first time. For as long as I've lived in the attic flat of my building, they've been up there, strutting, playing, crying, and reminding me with their every unfathomably loud step that they are as much a part of the fabric of this place as am I. And I'm happy to have them as upstairs neighbours. I find the thud of their landing over my head and the unashamed tunelessness of their vocals strangely comforting. They feel like lifelong companions, quietly yet loudly familiar. But what do I really know about them beyond what myths, movies, and my own surface-level observing have told me? That question was recently brought to me by a large crow that descended to sit on a graveyard railing as I walked past. Its arrival was as sudden as it was shadowy, and it stopped me in my tracks. For a moment, we were eye to eye, sizing each other up, a magnificent black and grey crow, and myself. The exchange was brief, but it left me certain that the bird instinctively knew more about my species than I do about its. Two days later, the same thing happened again. This time I was in a park when another crow swooped down to sit on the back of a bench where I was tying my laces. It let out a full-throated, open-hearted caw and fixed me with a deep stare. Same intensity, different bird. Or was it? Honestly, I have no idea. And research suggests the bird would have better chances of picking me out in a lineup than I'd have of identifying it among its fellow flock members. Several years ago, scientists carried out an experiment to see how well crows can remember human faces. It turns out they're masters of the art. The researchers wore threatening-looking masks when tagging individual birds. Not only were these birds able to recognize the masks on future occasions, a fact that was deduced from the noise they made upon seeing them again, but they also passed the information on to other birds who'd had no contact with the humans or masks involved. Pretty smart. One species of crow, which are members of the richly diverse and widely dispersed corvid family, have also been known to place hard nuts behind the wheels of parked cars, so that when the vehicle moves off, it'll roll over the walnuts and crack them open. Again, pretty clever. They've also been seen dropping nuts or mollusks from a great height onto hard surfaces to access the food they know to be hiding inside. Even smarter, yet there's more. One type of crow is the only species besides humans and some captive great apes known to be able to fashion tools to extract food from out-of-reach places. And, like the thirsty bird in one of Aesop's famed fables, they've also been observed using the weight of stones to get what they want. In a spell of dry weather, when the birds could find very little to drink, a thirsty crow found a pitcher with a little water in it. But the pitcher was high and had a narrow neck, and no matter how he tried, the crow could not reach the water. The poor thing felt as if he must die of thirst. Then an idea came to him. Picking up some small pebbles, he dropped them into the pitcher one by one. With each pebble, the water rose a little higher, until at last it was near enough so he could drink. But how did they get to be so intelligent? Being around in some form or another for as many as 17 million years has given them time to figure a few things out, but not every species that survived on Earth for that long has Corvid-style street smarts. I'm taking that question to tree worker and avid birder Matthias Janke, who's taking me to explore avian life on a stretch of land once dominated by the snaking wall that divided East and West Berlin.
You have this forest here. This is a forest that grew up when the wall came down and everything changed.
So this was just all empty. People can't see this, but I'm just standing looking at a long line, like a straight line of silver birch trees.
They are 35 years old, and before that there was a variety of fences and of sand. So if somebody would flee, he would leave footsteps on the grass. So they always had pesticide there to not allow any stuff to grow up there, so they could see if somebody had steps through the sand. And there were mines and there were shooting installations. That was very, very sad in this area. And now it's a 35-year-old stripe of birch trees and other trees as well that goes for miles and miles around just around the fields. That it's the border of the city. Yes.
It's very peaceful, and it's kind of hard to imagine that this was once such a place of terror.
Yes.
It's such a peaceful place now.
And it is. As we walk through the forest on a patch of ground that witnessed the worst of what people can do to each other, the air is filled with the scent of the coming spring and the lure of early morning birdsong. Woodpeckers, pigeons, blue tits, and skylarks skillfully flit between trees while the sun, still shy after a long winter in the shadows, dusts the area with promise. I'm learning about the crows that migrate to this part of Germany from Poland, Russia, and Scandinavia for a milder winter. That the black and grey ones I see around the city are hooded crows that live in large flocks, also known as murders, during the winter. That they operate according to a strict hierarchy and separate in the spring to mate, and that they've honed their intelligence through their relationships with humans. Then I witnessed something I'd certainly not been reckoning with.
Oh, look, there is a sparrowhawk, and there's a crow attacking it. There you have that. The sparrowhawk, he's breeding here in this area, and they're chasing each other. Now the sparrowhawk fights back. Yes, yes. They're just, they're fighting. They don't like each other. One is following the other. It's just who's up there attacks the other one, and then the other one fights back. Now the sparrowhawk chases the crow. And quiet maneuvers.
It had never occurred to me that a crow would go after a hawk. Not only because I'm used to seeing them eating scraps of pizza they find on the street, but because chasing an apex predator seems to be asking for trouble. But it turns out they have well-honed predatory instincts and are preceded by more than one reputation.
They belong to the corvids, the raven birds. And the raven was the one that was feeding on hanged people. Right. That gives them a bad touch, I think. And they are really tough animals. They're very clever. They empty nests. They eat young birds. They eat young rabbits if they find them. And so they are really aggressive.
I don't know what I'd been expecting, but this information undermined my image of the crow as an underappreciated member of the bird world and left me wondering what their more redeeming features might be.
They clean the landscape. The scavengers, they are very important to prevent diseases because they eat all the dead material. So So that, I think that's why they became so intelligent. They had to have a good mixture of being close to human beings because it was good for them, but being aware that they are not hunted and that they are not killed by farmers who wanted to get them away from their places. And that's how they figured out to be smart enough to just get along.
Yeah.
What they do good to other birds is they create nests that other birds use.
Maybe I've been naive when it comes to crows, carried away by their depicted mystery, their quiet, knowing, atonal contribution to the avian landscape, and their apparent mixture of underdog and underbelly. And for a moment, learning about their less endearing traits left me doubting my affections. But it didn't last. As I walked through the park today, the crows were out in full force, swooping, cawing, hopping and scavenging in the same way I've witnessed them doing all my life. And I realized with some relief that my feelings for them are wholly intact. Are they perfect birds? Probably not. But as Matthias pointed out, they're just doing what they have to do to get by. And in that regard, they're perhaps more like us than we care to consider.
This episode of Living Planet was produced by Tamsin Walker. It was edited and mixed by me, Neil King. Our sound engineer was Gert Georgi. If you have any questions or story suggestions, please just drop us a line or voice message to livingplanet@dw.com. And of course, you're very welcome to leave us a short and sweet review or rating wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening and sharing Living Planet.